Welcome for another Case Studies with Dr. K mini webinar. As you know, DRT started a new program where I cover a case once a month that reviews neurotransmitter results with sex steroids or stress hormones or elements. And I usually try to pick my favorite neurotransmitter case, and hopefully the interpretation and the explanations of why some things are going on with a given patient are helpful. And I hope you enjoy them. And today I'm really excited to introduce a guest speaker, Dr. Allison Smith. She's a clinical consultant at DRT. You may have spoken with her on the phones or have listened to her webinars. She is a regular at doing webinars for us. And I'm really excited for her to cover a case, Julia's case, a postmenopausal female patient that has severe sleep issues. And she will be talking about her neurotransmitter and saliva steroids results. And with that, I'll give it to Dr. Smith.
Thanks, Dr. Plasek. This is excellent. This is Julia. This is definitely a patient that I think a lot of us, our patients just like her, are filling our offices and want some support, especially for sleep. We have so many people struggling with sleep issues and so many providers who are struggling to provide individualized care to these folks who have tried everything. Usually they come to us on 100 different supplements and maybe some medications and lots of opinions about things that they've tried in the past maybe. And so it's really, it's a tough one to approach. So I think this really ended up being a really telling case. And I would say a profile that's really commonly seen here, and hopefully we'll give you some ideas for some of your more challenging sleep/menopause cases. So Julia is 51 years old. She's been in menopause for a couple of years now. I don't have all that information for her, but she sort of became menopausal in the normal time frame. She has moderate symptoms of hypothyroidism, but most severely, she's got more in the realm of high and low cortisol, low androgens and estrogen dominance, that whole progesterone deficiency picture that I think we're all so familiar with. She's on a lot of different supplements, vitamin D, some probiotics. She's already tried rhodiola and L-theanine. So you already kind of have the sense that you're going to have to get really creative with this patient. So she's depressed, she's anxious, she's not sleeping. She's going to be emailing you every day, letting you know how well or not well your treatment is working for her. So when she tested her salivary hormones, this is the picture we got. So she's telling us her subjective symptoms. And one of the things that we do that's really kind of nice is we give this back to you in a way that's easily sort of interpreted on the fly. So when you're sitting down to interpret the lab report, you can kind of see what the patient is telling us at the same time as they're spitting in the tubes and peeing on the urine strips, so you can get an idea of where they are at that moment. And you'll notice at the bottom there, you'll see a listing of different sort of diagnostic avenues you could go down based on their symptoms. And so she's talking a lot about high and low cortisol, a lot about low androgens and a lot about estrogen dominance and a lot about estrogen and progesterone deficiency. She's definitely got a yellow bar there for hypometabolism, which is our thyroid category. And so we're already thinking there may be some imbalances in the adrenals, maybe also estrogen progesterone system. So this is just a little digest of what she was telling us. We kind of took every single symptom she mentioned and the severity of that symptom and boiled it down to this. She's anxious, she's not sleeping, and she's super stressed. So instead of giving you all of her numbers, we'll just kind of give you the graphs that correspond to her saliva steroid results. And I think you will agree that her saliva estradiol is off the charts low. So it's below 0.5 essentially. And so that's about the bottom of our scale for free estradiol in the saliva. And so most people who are under 0.5 are feeling a lot of low estrogen symptoms and really are probably at risk for bone loss, and so we're extra concerned about this individual. Her progesterone is kind of at the low end of what we would expect for somebody in menopause. And I mean, she's certainly not where we would expect to see a 70-year-old, but she's almost there. She's progesterone in postmenopause we think of as being mostly adrenal. So if it's more of an adrenal marker, we're maybe a little concerned about her adrenals here. She's on the low side. Testosterone, high, which can be associated with blood sugar imbalances and higher insulin levels, which might be a place we poke around with her, depending on how she responds to treatment of the adrenals and maybe a lower glycemic load kind of a diet. And then saliva DHEAS is low, which we kind of expect with adrenal dysfunction. And then cortisol, she's a little all over the place. She's kind of high normal in the morning. She's a little elevated before lunch, drops down pretty low in the evening, and then she's just coming back to the normal range at night before bed, before she has a terrible night's sleep. So here are her neurotransmitter results that she did in the same sample. And so in the urine, of course, but sent in the same kit done on the same day. And what we're seeing standing out here at the same time as her super low estradiol, kind of keep that in the back of your mind when we're looking at this, is her serotonin and 5-HIAA, which 5-HIAA, you'll remember, is the metabolic sort of degradation product of serotonin. And if you'll notice, that 5-HIAA is quite a bit higher than the optimal range, while serotonin is sort of at the low end of the optimal range. So there's this sort of disparity between 5-HIAA and serotonin with a higher metabolite level than the parent neurotransmitter itself. So we know she's sort of hyper-degrading this neurotransmitter. So we want to look for a similar pattern down the road as well, to know that maybe estrogen, which is a natural MAO inhibitor, how much that might be playing a role in this. So GABA looks pretty good. We're in the optimal range. Glycine, below optimal. And of course, we're getting closer to the bottom of the range there. So we're worried about, there are a lot of things glycine does, but whenever I see a low glycine and a low glutamate together, I always think about oxidative processes. And so we're already kind of thinking about that as at least contributing to her stress perception. Histamine looks good. PEA is sort of hanging on to the bottom of that optimal range, maybe a little bit on the low side. You'll notice dopamine and DOPAC, we see a similar pattern as with serotonin and 5-HIAA, which is kind of why we picked this case, because this is a really common thing. We see this hyper MAO activity sort of degrading serotonin and dopamine and creating more of these metabolites. So DOPAC and HVA are much higher than dopamine. And then this sort of low-ish norepinephrine level, which is representative of sympathetic tone, since most of this is coming from, or 80% is coming from, the central nervous system. And then the rest of her adrenal markers look okay. Norepinephrine and epinephrine look okay. VMA, awesome, right about where we like to see it. So let's look at this in a little bit of a different way. So serotonin system, if we break it down, of course, we always give these this page in each lab report that comes with a neurotransmitter test. So you can kind of go through and see, well, how can I support this system? Maybe some iron, some B6, copper and B2, you know, you can kind of figure out where you can push on some of these pathways. But so we know that serotonin is normal and 5-HIAA is high. That matters in relationship to her low estradiol, because estradiol regulates serotonin biosynthesis, but it also regulates its degradation. And so it's a mild MAO inhibitor, a natural one. And that's why so many patients who are postmenopausal, who have these low estradiol levels, who are untreated, end up with depression and symptoms of depression, and often have a hard time getting effective treatment for that without estradiol, though it can be done. Anyway, serotonin is highly tied into estradiol, and so is really important to kind of test these things at the same time. So what do we do? You could treat with estradiol, and a lot of our providers are doing that. Some people you just can't test or you can't treat with estradiol. Maybe you have somebody who has a past history of breast cancer or a family history of breast cancer or somebody who's petrified of hormone replacement therapy. There are other options for treating this sort of low serotonin, this sort of too fast MAO system, even without using MAO inhibitors, which have sort of gone a bit out of favor because of their side effects, sometimes massive side effects. But even SSRIs and SNRIs can be effective at treating this type of depression and anxiety that can arise from this imbalance. So there are other options. There are other herbal options as well. There are herbal MAOIs like kava is an MAOB inhibitor, passion flower, curcumin. There's a whole bunch of them, and then there are several papers that have looked at different herbal compounds that do this. And then there are also other herbs that support that decrease the degradation of downregulate the reuptake of serotonin, like St. John's wort is a good example of that. So that's serotonin. We're kind of keeping all of this in the back of our minds. We're already thinking estradiol would be a target of therapy for serotonin. But when we look at glycine and this sort of lower glycine that we're seeing here, whenever I'm looking at glycine, I think about methylation because we have so many patients with MTHFR mutations, and sometimes that sort of deficiency there can funnel into what we see in the neurotransmitter profiles, and glycine is one of those places. Methylfolate and B6 can support the glycine system, and glycine is used in a lot of processes, so it's really difficult to ascertain exactly what's pulling on glycine stores. One really typical place we see glycine pulled, certainly in our line of work, is towards glutathione, and we do see glycine oftentimes happening in parallel with a low glutamate. And both glycine and glutamate are part of the formation of glutathione. So whenever we see this sort of low glycine, we're concerned about their glutathione system and the ability of this person to detoxify their tissues, essentially. So this is actually a really nice schematic that Dr. Plazek created for us that shows where all of the hormones, all the sex hormones essentially, come in and regulate all the different neurotransmitters. And then you can see too, where most of them really interact with our methylation cascades here. We use SAMe quite a bit for degradation of a lot of these amino acids, and for glycine as well, which uses the methylfolate. All right, so glutamate. We are all sort of expecting to see a high glutamate when we have somebody who has excitatory symptoms like anxiety, but it's not unusual to see somebody with a low glutamate, especially together with a low glycine, with anxiety and difficulty sleeping and stress because of what we were just talking about. People who have increased oxidative processes going on in the body and the brain may have hyper excitation symptoms in the absence of glutamate. And this is because all of those resources are being shuttled to glutathione. And so if you give glutathione or you give its precursor N-acetylcysteine, people sing your praises. They feel better almost immediately. It does not take long for N-acetylcysteine to start lifting that burden and you'll see glutamate levels and glycine levels increase. And suddenly they're much more able to respond to L-theanine therapy, for instance, that uses glycine as its chemical messenger to modulate processes in the brain, for instance. So all of a sudden your treatments start working better. There's where glutamate kind of fits into the glutathione production mechanism there. And then, of course, thyroid hormone, I just wanted to point out, thyroid hormone plays into the methylation cascades and recycling methyl groups as well. So our patient here has some symptoms of hypothyroidism. We may want to go ahead and test her thyroid and make sure that she's got enough going on here to activate her riboflavin in her methylation cycles. We definitely would want to consider at least starting with N-acetylcysteine or glutathione to sort of set the terrain so that she can respond to whatever else we decide for her, whether it's hormones or alternatives to hormones, or a combination of both. So as far as the rest of the excitatory neurotransmitters, I'm just kind of starting up at the top here with PEA. It was a little bit on the low side, which could be, she could be pulling on her phenylalanine towards the dopamine pathway and making DOPAC and HBA. You know, it's hard to know exactly what's happening here, but we do see this sort of tendency toward dopamine metabolites at the expense of everything else, maybe even. But PEA, you can push pretty easily with some D-L-phenylalanine and B6, and that support is pretty helpful for people who have trouble focusing and that sort of brain foggy symptom. She did mention but didn't prioritize very high. And the N-acetylcysteine often will help with those types of symptoms as well. Going on down to dopamine and DOPAC as well. Oh, let's see. Let me back up here to norepinephrine, because she did mention some major symptoms of fatigue, depression, but also anxiety and stress, which is also a big pull on the norepinephrine system. So we definitely want to support her there. And then zooming up to the top there, back to what I was saying about dopamine, very similar to what we were saying about serotonin as well, is that we have this normal dopamine, normal serotonin, but these higher metabolites, which tells us something about what's happening with MAO. So MAO as well as MAOB affected here. This is just a little bit of a wrap-up slide on how to approach a low PEA, an MAO that's really sort of fast and dense and we want to slow down, and then also how to address a low norepinephrine. And we'll put this all together at the end too. I love this slide. I want to make this for each patient. So, main symptoms that are bringing you in, and what we're seeing in the labs. And so just a reminder of what we saw in the saliva labs, this low estrogen and low progesterone, that's not a surprise in a postmenopausal woman who's symptomatic, and a low DHEAS with as many adrenal symptoms as she has. But this higher testosterone, this making us wonder about her blood sugar a little bit, her insulin levels, and these sort of high and low cortisols that also can play into blood sugar and also the stress system as well. And her neurotransmitters with the high serotonin and dopamine metabolites compared to serotonin and dopamine, and low glycine glutamate oxidation, and low norepinephrine, which also has something to do with that low estradiol. So now the fun part is to figure out what to do. And I thought I would share some of my thoughts on what I would do with her if she was sitting in front of me. And I would definitely work with diet and movement and biofeedback, because I think those three areas are going to set the tone for how well she's going to respond to whatever we give her. So the Mediterranean diet studies really well for anxiety, cardiovascular risk, stress perception. I think, you know, it can be modified and tinkered with until you find the perfect thing. But, you know, the more veggies, the better. The more essential fatty acids, the better. I think people gravitate away sometimes from a really good diet into habits that aren't so great, and sometimes they don't really notice. And so I think if we don't go there with people, then we have trouble. We end up chasing our tails with treatment sometimes, because the other things that we put on top of a sort of a standard American diet aren't always effective enough. So going back to diet's really important. Yoga, hands down, for anxiety, I have found works wonders. 3 times a week, if they can, for an hour at a time. Hatha yoga is awesome. I've heard a little more about Kundalini yoga, especially for anxiety and stress. You'll see a different patient staring back at you. There are home biofeedback systems. I feel like I talk about these all day on the phone. There's loads of them. Probably there's a top three out there. And if you have questions, contact me. I would love to talk to you about it. But they are available as downloads, as apps on your phone. And so patients can basically buy a little device, either an ear sensor or a wrist sensor or a chest strap or something that can help, that hooks into that system, that can help them achieve their own balance once, twice, 3 times a day, depends on how much they need it. And it helps people sleep. It helps people perceive less stress, even if the stressor hasn't changed. And many, many, many other benefits to biofeedback. And it puts the control into their hands, most importantly, and they can track their progress, which is really fun. I would consider doing some additional testing for her. I would definitely run a thyroid panel and see if we're working against anything there. When I see cortisol starting to be up and down, sometimes we start to see some low T3s, and you know, once you have much less cellular activation and less cellular iodine, and that whole cascade of events can lead to just, I would say, a less optimal response to therapy with the thyroid being low like that. I would also want to look at her A1C, which is probably normal, would be my guess, but that her insulin levels are probably high after meals. 3 hours postprandial, I like to look there because their insulin should be totally baseline, but people who are early insulin resistant are still high there. So that's often the first place you start to see problems. Fasting insulin may be helpful if they're progressed enough. The diurnal norepi and epi, I think, should probably be run on anybody who has sleep disturbance issues, because that's a real sleeper cause, excuse my pun, of sleep issues. When we look at the pooled norepinephrine and epinephrine in the urine, I think of it as more like looking at a pooled cortisol, a 24-hour cortisol in the urine. It gives you information about high or low, but if you're normal, I don't think that you can necessarily say that you're normal, because they are diurnal. And so if you're low when you should be high and high when you should be low, you could be extremely symptomatic while simultaneously having a completely normal pooled level. So I would definitely either add that on to her testing or order it separately, especially if we weren't getting traction on her therapy. So endocrine support, certainly with the low estradiol and progesterone and being 51, I would definitely consider using a little bit of estradiol, either in a patch, and you know, a 0.025 to a 0.05, just starting her low and figuring out where she gets comfortable. Some people don't sleep when they're low in estradiol, period, no matter what. And so this may solve her problem straight away. It would fix the serotonin issue. It fixes the dopamine issue. And once there's more serotonin on board, guess what? There's more melatonin on board. Everything just works better with estradiol, and the brain loves estradiol. Progesterone is every woman's best friend. Well, it's not every woman's best friend. Some women cannot do progesterone, but it's most women's best friend, especially oral progesterone, because when you take oral progesterone and it goes through first pass metabolism, it becomes its neuroactive steroid metabolite called allopregnanolone and crosses the blood-brain barrier, and it hits the central nervous system in a bolus, essentially. And so you get this nice sedative effect with oral progesterone therapy. And so that would be my first choice for this patient. And I would imagine that would probably clean up a lot of what we're seeing in the neurotransmitters that are causing her anxiety and stress and sleep problems. DHEA being as low as it is, you could give DHEA, and she does have some low androgen symptoms. My hold back on the DHEA would be that she's got a higher testosterone level, and we don't want to lose her by making her, you know, sprout hair on her face and lose scalp hair and have acne. So I would probably use that as a second line when she starts getting a little healthier and we figure out what's going on with her blood sugar. And then HPA axis support, I would really want to include rhodiola, which is really good for that kind of low sympathetic tone anxiety that sometimes people can get. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in the neurotransmitter support section. But adaptogens like ashwagandha can be really helpful for sleep. Some people take it right before bed. There are some, like shatavari is a formula that has Ayurvedic herbs that include ashwagandha in there that can be really helpful as adaptogens and really nice support before bed. Neurotransmitter support, number one would be N-acetylcysteine and glutathione for that oxidative support. We want to make sure that glutathione is being made and glutamate and glycine can come up. Curcumin and passionflower are good MAO inhibitors, especially for patients who are not going to be taking estradiol. Passionflower can be taken in a tea. Curcumin's trickier because it's difficult to absorb and is quite expensive, but is very well studied. We spoke a bit about rhodiola, but it might be a good adaptogen for this patient, especially. And then for her, once she's established on this therapy, then I would start her on some GABA and theanine at night before bed, because sometimes with rhodiola therapy, we get a little bit of an increase in norepinephrine and epinephrine, which we kind of want in this case, but we don't want to overstep. We want to make sure we have plenty of GABA in the system to gate norepinephrine and epinephrine release from the adrenals. Thanks, guys. I'm going to turn it back to Kate, who is going to talk about Loretta for next month.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. That was so good. I am grateful that you came on board today and gave this presentation. And to our audience, I just wanted to say that when you call our clinical consultants for support on a given report, that's kind of the expected walkthrough that you can receive from our clinical consultant staff. They're all really, really awesome, and they will walk you through a report and kind of, troubleshoot with you and discuss some ideas about a particular patient and kind of provide support, which is oftentimes.
Everybody is so different. And I think providers often will say, oh, I feel like I should know this stuff by now. And they'll kind of get embarrassed that they've called a lot. But it's a steep learning curve, and everybody's a little bit different enough to make you need a sounding board. And that's totally fine. Always feel free to call in.
Yeah. Well, that concludes Julia's case, and next month you can expect me to be back to talk about Loretta. I'm really excited to talk about Loretta. She's a postmenopausal female in her 60s with a long history of breast cancer. So I will be talking about her neurotransmitters, of course, and diurnal stress hormones, but also I will be addressing the role of elements and heavy metals, and I'll give you a little hint. We'll be talking a lot about mercury and selenium in Loretta's case, so stay tuned. Thanks for listening.